Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In the history of the world, one country has deployed nuclear weapons against an enemy.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
That was President Harry Truman in 1945. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. 70 years ago this month, American bombers dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. Tens of thousands of people died instantly, and the most conservative estimates are that about 130,000 were dead of bomb-related injuries and illnesses within a few months of the attack. Many Americans were taught that the bombs were a sort of necessary evil to bring an end to an exhausting war, spare U.S. casualties, and ensure an Allied victory. My guest says a closer examination of the facts challenges that narrative, and he joins us to explain. Christian Appy is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You can read his recent article, The Indefensible Hiroshima Revisionism That Haunts America to This Day, online at salon.com. Christian, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So my parents were taught in the 60s that the bomb was the only way to end the war. I was taught something similar in the 80s. My children confirmed over dinner the other night they were taught the same thing in school. It's not so surprising that some Americans might look at all the facts and agree with that conclusion. It is remarkable that three generations of Americans have, for the most part, not seemed all that curious about whether what they were taught was accurate or not.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, in the run-up to the 70th anniversary, I was wondering if we've had anything close to a full moral or political reckoning with our status as the only country in the world to have used atomic weapons on human beings. And my conclusion is that we really haven't. It seems to me that the official justifications that you outlined at the start, that kind of legitimizing narrative for the atomic bombing of Japan, is one of the most deeply embedded narratives in our modern history. This idea that the bombing was essential to end the war quickly, and that in so doing, it averted the necessity of a full-scale invasion of the home islands, thus sparing, and here the numbers have increased over the years, and many people are just absolutely certain that, of course, it spared at least a 500,000 American lives and maybe many more Japanese.
Asking these kinds of questions forces us to recast our notions of World War II, doesn't it? At least our role within World War II as the good war, and it asks us to take a critical look at our view of ourselves as a nation that loves peace.
Right, and that seems to be very difficult for us to do, this idea of the greatest generation having fought this just war against fascism is very powerfully and deeply felt, and there is a basis to it that I share. I do believe it was a just cause, but I think we need to look at it a little more deeply and remind ourselves that it is possible to wage a just war relying on unjust means. And this was a conclusion that is not just the product of contemporary moralizing historians looking back retroactively on that period. It turns out that even in 1945, there were really significant people who disagreed with the necessity of using atomic weapons and their morality, including, and this I think will come as a surprise to most Americans, 6 out of 7 of the 5-star general and admirals in the American military at the time believed that Japan had already been effectively defeated by conventional American forces and, of course, a very devastating firebombing of some 67 Japanese cities, and that they would surrender prior to any use of atomic weapons, particularly if President Truman were willing to back away from his insistence on an unconditional surrender and consider allowing the Japanese to keep the emperor on his throne, at least in a ceremonial fashion, which is, in fact, exactly the agreement that Truman accepted after the atomic weapons had been dropped. So there was what I try in this article to recover is a sense that there were so-called revisionist thinking to the dropping of atomic weapons, even from the beginning. This is not just some kind of retroactive moralizing.
What did you learn about how seriously President Truman considered alternatives to the bomb?
Well, the historical record seems to be pretty clear that Truman gave almost no serious consideration to alternatives that others were thinking about and even presenting to him, especially after the United States successfully tested a bomb out in the New Mexico desert at Alamogordo, the so-called Trinity test in the middle of July. And once he got that word, he seemed even more inflexible in thinking about other ways to end the war, even a kind of wait and see. I mean, one thing that needs to be remembered is that at a conference at Yalta earlier in 1945, before the European war had ended, the Allies, Truman and Churchill, asked Stalin if he would enter the Japanese war after the Germans had been defeated. And they sought his entry, you know, and he agreed, saying that exactly 90 days after peace in Europe, he would enter the war against Japan. And that turned out to be April 8th, precisely 2 days after the first atomic bomb was used on Hiroshima. And he made good on that. And in fact, one thing that seems clear now, I think many historians agree with this, is that the entrance of the Soviet Union in the Far East was as important a factor in Japanese surrender as the use of atomic weapons. And that leads to a larger consideration of the possibility that Truman was motivated not merely to end the war quickly in order to save American lives, but to end the war quickly so that the Soviet Union would not be able to gain a greater claim over territory in the Far East, and also to send a very powerful a message of an American, at that point, atomic monopoly, in hopes that it might make the Soviet Union more manageable not just in Asia, but in Europe as well. And this is precisely the kind of advice he was getting from his Secretary of State, James Burns. And so the big point is that there's a lot more to the politics of the period than just this sort of a simple narrative that is still, as you say, in our high school textbooks, that it was done to end the war and save American lives, and in that sense could even be seen as a kind of merciful ending to the war, a kind of mass mercy killing rather than a slaughter of tens of thousands of civilians.
The death toll that you cite is higher than a lot of the estimates that have been published elsewhere. You say it was at a minimum 250,000 dead. Can you talk about how you arrived at that number?
Well, actually, there are estimates that are quite a bit higher than that. I mean, the Japanese for a long time have thought when you count all the people that ultimately died of radiation poisoning, the figure would be 200,000 for Hiroshima and 140,000 for Nagasaki. I think that a more reasonable estimate is in the 200s, I would say that the lowest one that I think would be reliable for the two bombings would be around 220,000.
How were Hiroshima and Nagasaki chosen as the targets for those bombings?
Well, that raises an interesting question. One of the other statements Truman made just a short couple days after the one that you aired at the top of the program came on August 9th when he, speaking from the White House, said that the world will note that the United States has dropped an atomic weapon on Hiroshima, a military base, and we did that in hopes of avoiding as much as possible civilian casualties. Now, of course, that was a complete fabrication. Truman had been well briefed on the bomb and the testing, and understood that the victims there would be overwhelmingly a civilian, and lots of them. And indeed, the targets were chosen not because of their military significance, but because they wanted to choose cities that had not already been devastated by American firebombing. And by the middle summer of 1945, there were very few left. In fact, only a handful had not been severely damaged by American bombing. And these cities were referred to by American policymakers as, quote-unquote, virgin targets. So Nagasaki and Hiroshima were one of two of those very few virgin targets. And they clearly wanted to be able to measure as accurately as possible the full impact of this new extraordinary weapon that had just been really produced at in secret, of course, through the Manhattan Project, an extraordinary expensive program. And at one point, actually, Secretary of War Henry Stimson went to President Truman and said, you know, I'm kind of worried that with all this firebombing, we're running out of targets that will allow us to really show the strength of the atomic weapon. And Truman, according to Stimson's diary, laughed and said that he understood.
We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake, we shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
That was President Truman addressing the nation after the destruction of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, before the Nagasaki bombing. Why was there a second bombing?
Well, actually, there was a second bombing because Truman had really deferred to the military command, in particular the director of the Manhattan Project, General Leslie Groves, as to the timetable of the dropping of weapons. And there were, I think at that time, three of them available. And so, interestingly enough, there wasn't a kind of micromanagement from the White House over the timing. He basically said, when they're ready, use them. So it turned out that the second bomb was initially intended to be used several days later. And had that actually, that timetable been followed, it's possible that a surrender would have been reached before it was used, because it actually took some days for leaders in Tokyo to understand the devastating consequences of the first bomb in Hiroshima, simply because all the communication and everything had been wiped out. And what happened is the weather indicated that it would be better to move up the timing of the Nagasaki bombing instead of doing it on the 11th or 12th or 13th, to do it earlier. And so that's why it came in such rapid succession. But that was really left to the military command.
Christian Appy is with us. He's professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We're talking about his recent article published in Salon. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Christian Appy, who is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and recently published an article in Salon called The Indefensible Hiroshima Revisionism That Haunts America to This Day. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Christian, just out of curiosity, was that headline yours or theirs?
It was theirs. Yeah. And these articles float around the internet, and they all these sites put on their own titles. I think the original one I used, which first appeared at tomdispatch.com, was our, quote, merciful ending to the, quote, good war.
Is there anything you would change about the Salon? Would you prefer to have your original headline on there?
You always prefer to have the original, but... yeah, I mean, clearly people do defend it. I mean, it's still a very hot-button item in our public memory and history. I mean, just judging by the emails I've gotten, or you look at the comments section at Salon, and clearly, you know, they're very, very split. And the polls indicate that as well. The most recent poll indicated that still a majority of Americans, but not such a big majority, 56% believe that the atomic bombing of Japan was justified. And that seems to be changing a bit for younger Americans. Those under 30 years of age are below 50% in their support.
All right, let's talk about, to the extent that it was perceived to be a merciful ending or a way to end the war and spare additional casualties, what kinds of estimates was Truman given from his military commanders about the cost in human lives and also financial cost of a ground invasion and air invasion mm-hmm. of the Japanese islands?
Well, there certainly was concern about how bloody and costly an invasion of the home islands were, and a concern given wartime perceptions of the Japanese, which were quite crude, to say the least, and virulently racist, to be quite honest. That is, this caricature of the Japanese, which was commonplace in American magazines, images of them as apes and reptiles and vermin, and this notion that they're so fanatical in their loyalty to the emperor and to the nation that they would, every last man, woman, and child, fight to the bitter end. And the fighting in the Pacific had indeed been incredibly brutal and even savage, and there have been great casualties on both sides. So all of this did figure into the estimates. But when Truman did charge the Joint Chiefs of Staff with doing a study, what came back was an estimate of around 40,000 American deaths if indeed we had to invade the home islands, and that they were scheduled for months later, so there would have been time to sort of wait and see. The first of the invasions was scheduled for November 1st, 45, and the second for March. So that 40,000, that's not insignificant. It represents about a little bit over 40% of all the American losses in the Pacific for the war as a whole. But it's not even close to the kind of estimates that came later. Really, these estimates of a half a million or a million or so were post-war numbers, and I think were quite consciously used to build an after-the-fact defense of that decision. Henry Stimson was asked to write an article, the former Secretary of War, for Harper's that came out in 1947, 2 years after the war. And that's sort of the first time you see in a semi-official document or a document written by a prior official using the figure of at least a half a million American lives, perhaps as many as a million. And that became a kind of sacred numerology. Again, you see this in textbooks to the present day. And one extreme version of this came back in 1991, when then-President George H.W. Bush was praising Truman, looking back on World War II, praising him for his tough, decisive decision that, he said, quote, spared millions of American lives. So, of course, we can never know. You cannot replay history. There are no mulligans. It's all becomes speculation, right? So we don't know if a land invasion would have been necessary, or if in fact Japan might have surrendered minus atomic bombs, simply because Russia was already devastating parts of Manchuria at great loss of life, or that other terms of surrender might have evolved. In any case, we don't know what would have happened, but it is certainly true that the original estimates were far below the ones that are so commonplace in public memory.
Earlier, you mentioned the Trinity test at Alamogordo in July of 1945. Surely Truman had to be thinking about what actions he would take had that turned out to be a colossal failure.
Right. And he, when he was in Potsdam meeting with the other allies, which, of course, then included the Soviet Union and Stalin, he has a very interesting line where he says, once the Russians enter the war again, the Japs are finny. In other words, they will lose once that happens. And then he says, "I am certain they will once Manhattan appears over their skies," meaning atomic bombs. So he was aware that if in fact the test didn't work, there were other ways to end the war, both the Russian alliance and the possibility of an eventual invasion. And he also knew from his military commanders that we by then, after the Battle of Okinawa, had effectively virtually total control of the seas and skies around and over Japan. So we really had an effective blockade, and they were running very short of food and fuel and arms toward the end of the war. They even had hundreds of thousands of civilians trying to squeeze kind of a fuel that you can make out of bamboo, believe it or not, that they were going to use for jet fuel. And yes, they were preparing for an invasion, but they were training civilians with sharpened bamboo stakes. That's, you know, how short they were on weapons and so forth. So, yeah, he had to be considering these other options. But once, as I say, he knew that the bomb would work, or had worked at least in the test, he seems to have been behaving with much greater confidence about bringing the war to an end, and really wanted to get on with it.
You said that it took a while for Tokyo to get a full sense of the extent of the damage at Hiroshima, and in the interim, the Nagasaki bombing happened. What kind of intelligence did the United States have about the immediate damage done, and about knowledge of that and action, plans of action taking place in Tokyo to respond?
Well, I'm not sure I know exactly what we knew about the impact, other than the fact that it was clearly devastating. And they did, of course, have the debriefing of the crew itself that saw the extraordinary effect of the bomb, at least from a height of 30,000 feet. It is true that we had cracked the Japanese code so that we were fully aware that over the summer Japan had been putting out feelers through the Soviet Union indicating that at least these civilian leadership in Japan, including the emperor and the prime minister, were interested in hoping to reach surrender terms that would allow the emperor to stay on his throne. So again, just as we can't know what might have happened with a land invasion, we can't really know what would have, you know, whether or not Japan really would have gone forward, you know, even earlier than the atomic bombs with a surrender, had Truman been willing to accept those conditional terms. Interestingly enough, just a side note, earlier in the summer, when Acting Secretary of State Joseph Grew urged Truman to think about a conditional surrender that would allow them to keep the emperor, he seemed very open to it. And it was really only after the testing at Trinity of the bomb where he no longer gave any consideration to that, even though Secretary of War Stimson continued to urge him to accept it prior to the use of atomic bombs.
How much was Truman thinking about the signal this sent to the entire rest of the world that America was not to be trifled with?
Well, this is something that historians have been able to learn more about over the years, and it seems quite clear that his determination to demonstrate American power to the Soviet Union was at least one factor, if not the most decisive factor. so that it wasn't just a military concern with ending the war, but a concern to kind of check a power that he, in his own mind, and other policymakers too, were already beginning to perceive as the next enemy. And so you really have, with the last act of World War II, the first act of the Cold War, in terms of that, the sort of imagining what might happen. And I think, in fact, that was a colossal miscalculation, because, of course, our use of the weapons did nothing at all to check Soviet ambitions. And indeed, they knew we were developing a bomb through their spy networks. And as soon as we used it, they ratcheted up their effort to speed up their own development of it, which came 4 years later. And so then, of course, one of the major legacies of our use of these bombs was an extraordinary nuclear arms race that you know, ultimately produced over 70,000 nuclear warheads. We're down some from that, but we still have, suffice it to say, plenty to destroy the planet. And these weapons are now in possession of nine countries. So I would say that the two great existential threats to our planet remain atomic, the danger of a nuclear war, and what we now perceive as a newer threat, climate change, which would take presumably greater time to destroy the planet. But those are the two, and I think the movements against both should be more clearly joined.
I don't mean to imply that this is a justification one way or another, but do you believe that it's possible that the demonstration of the capability of these weapons on a human city has acted as a deterrent, has been a factor in, despite the proliferation of nuclear weapons that we've seen since the end of the Second World War, we have not seen one enemy deploy such a weapon against another?
You know, that to me is kind of unknowable. I don't really know how to answer that. And it is true that people were talking that way. The president of Harvard, who was an important scientist and engaged in the Manhattan Project, James Conant, actually used that as his defense for the bomb, that this would actually be crucial in demonstrating to the world that never again should these horrible weapons be used. Now, that argument would have more hold more water with me if, in fact, in the wake of the use, the United States had been able to work out an agreement with the rest of the world saying that we would put the remaining weapons that we had into international control or destroy them and try to gain agreement from the rest of the world that no one would develop them. But that, in fact, obviously didn't take place.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Will is on the line in Dallas. Hello, Will.
Hi. So I think you kind of addressed kind of the core of my question, but I guess I'll try to rephrase it in some ways. Had Truman and his cabinet decided not to use nuclear weapon to end the war, how do you think that would have shaped the current dialogue we have as far as proliferation and disarmament goes in certain, you know, world events such as the Iran nuclear talks?
Well, it's unknowable, but again, I think it could only have helped because we would have been in a much better moral position, I think, to lead the world toward complete, not just non-proliferation, but abolition of nuclear weapons had we been the first to develop and the first really to renounce without using nuclear weapons. It would have put us in a better position. But that is to ask, of course, for a lot of historical rewriting and an evolution of a much more benign Cold War. So there is a lot of what-ifs behind this speculation. But, you know, there are some historians who think that, for example, if the vice president at the time of FDR's death were not Harry Truman, who was picked in the 44 convention to replace Henry Wallace, that Wallace was much more open to are much more opposed to the nuclear weapons and a sort of hardline approach to the Cold War. But again, this is all interesting speculation. But as I tell my students, it's sort of hard enough to figure out history as it actually happens than to try to understand what might have happened if X, Y, or Z had been different.
The U.S. and Japan today are allies. There has still never been a formal apology for the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And my understanding is there's also never been a formal apology, right, for the bombing at Pearl Harbor.
Right. You know, very few nations are particularly good at apologizing. So, I was offering a critique of our own resistance to national contrition. Japan still has a lot to apologize for in terms of the war crimes committed throughout Asia, perhaps most obviously in China, and with incidents like the so-called Rape of Nanking. And then, of course, we've come to know in recent years more about the sexual enslavement, really, of many Asian women, particularly Koreans, for their, to use as prostitutes for Japanese troops. I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that's going to happen anytime soon. You never know. Only rarely have we done that in our history. We did apologize, in fact, in 1988 to those Japanese Americans, at least those who were still alive, who had been interned by our government during World War II, well over half of them being American citizens and not a single one of them ever having been found guilty of treason or espionage. And they were offered some compensation as well. But that's really the exception. The tendency, I think, in our political culture has been, not to apologize, and that this would be somehow seen as an expression of weakness.
We're speaking this hour with Christian Appy. He's professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and has a recent article in Salon and also Tom Dispatch about the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the American response to them in the 70 years that have passed since. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with University of Massachusetts historian Professor Christian Appy. His recent article appeared in many places, including Salon, under the headline, "The Indefensible Hiroshima Revisionism That Haunts America to This Day." If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Christian, it does seem that we could have displayed the awesome power of the atomic bomb in a location that would do a great deal of damage but result in far fewer civilian casualties. Was there any discussion of this at all?
There was, particularly among a number of the scientists that were involved in the Manhattan Project. But again, it was not an alternative that Truman took seriously. And one of the arguments against it was that if you did have a test on an unpopulated site, what if the bomb doesn't work and it's a dud? Our credibility around the bomb would be lost and would not work. So that didn't happen. But there were a number of people who thought that at least should be tried.
800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Bill in Fort Worth. Hello, Bill.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I recall seeing a documentary at some point in time where it was talking about that the Japanese were on the cusp of creating their own nuclear weapon that day, and that there was a an American journalist there who actually saw a test, and just wondering if there was any truth to that. I don't know. You never know about documentaries sometimes these days.
No, there really isn't anything to that. They did have a very rudimentary nuclear program, but it didn't get very far at all. In fact, the Germans were farther along, but they too ended up abandoning it during the course of the war. And indeed, it was the threat of a German development of the bomb that first spurred Albert Einstein to write a letter to President Roosevelt, urging him to develop a similar program in case Germany were to develop it, so that we would have that that capacity as well. A decision, by the way, that Einstein deeply regretted to his death.
Lots of Americans will have different opinions about the way this turned out and about the appropriate action. I am, again, curious about why this history remains relatively undiscussed in American society. In the essay, you detail a landmark exhibition that was planned at the Smithsonian to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. Can you tell us what was planned and then what ultimately was presented?
Yeah, it's really a fascinating moment in the history of public memory. This is now 20 years ago for what was then going to be the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum had planned a really very ambitious exhibit. You know, they had typically been noted for exhibits that were kind of uncritical, triumphal celebrations of American military science and technology. They didn't want to do another one of those. The curators and the historical consultants they brought in thought that they would do something much more thought-provoking. They had this extraordinary artifact that had been refurbished, which was the fuselage of the Enola Gay, that is the B-29 superfortress that carried and dropped the first of the atomic bombs. But around this amazing artifact, they were going to include a whole set of images and text that would teach visitors about not just the development of the bomb, but the debates around its use and its long-term consequences and legacies, as a way of moving the discussion beyond the end of World War II and the sort of traditional narrative that it ended the war and saved lives, to go on to think about its consequences in terms of the Cold War and the nuclear arms race. And the script that was the planning script for all of this got in the hands of the Air Force Association, and they leaked it to the press, and this caused a firestorm of criticism of the Smithsonian Institute, attacked primarily by conservative organizations for political correctness, historical revisionism, for insulting American veterans of that war by suggesting that, the bombing that had saved their lives was, in fact, immoral. It wasn't just conservatives. The United States Senate decided to weigh in on this, simply at this point, a planned exhibit, and they passed unanimously a resolution, Democrats and Republicans alike, condemning the National Air and Space Museum its quote, revisionism, and that it should be reminded, I'm almost directly quoting the resolution, that the Enola Gay played a momentous role in bringing to a, quote, merciful ending World War II, thus saving thousands of American lives. So, again, as I say, this legitimizing narrative is as deeply embedded as any I can think of in our history. And part of it has to do with, this is my view of it, I think that World War II has become such an iconic emblem of American virtue and righteousness and exceptionalism, this sort of very broad faith that the United States is not simply superior in its power and wealth, but in its virtues and morality and so forth. And people are always sort of using that as the touchstone for American exceptionalism, so that anything that taints it or challenges it, I think, rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
It's interesting.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's interesting that in the immediate aftermath of the dropping of the bomb, there was at least more ambivalence, it seems, from Americans trying to digest this thing that had been done.
Yeah, I agree. That's what really struck me as odd when I sort of raised the question at the beginning, have we come closer to sort of questioning or doubting or thinking about the moral implications of the bombing than we were 7 years ago? And, you know, I think in some ways, no, because if just a year after the war ended, John Hersey, the famous journalist, went over to Japan and interviewed survivors of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and produced this extraordinary little book simply called Hiroshima that traces the experiences of six survivors of that bombing. And it became a bestseller and indeed was read aloud over the ABC radio. And, various religious groups were thinking about the moral implications. And indeed, one of the first things that people thought about, well, is if maybe it did end the war, and 85, polls show that 85% of Americans supported it, but yet still, I think many of the supporters were thinking, on the other hand, this might not bode well for the future, because if somebody else gains this technology, and science being science, it's almost inevitable that others will. Some future enemy of ours could put a target around our cities, and this could lead to the most dire consequences. So there was that kind of thinking that has popped up again and again. I mean, we have had anti-nuclear movements. They've been kind of cyclical. It rose in the 50s and early 60s, and it did succeed, for example, in ending atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. And then the Vietnam War kind of sort of put aside anti-nuclear activism, but it rose again in the 80s with the freeze movement and beyond. And there's certainly, in the year since 9/11, been a lot of concern about so-called, rogue groups and nations getting a hold of nuclear technology, but not, in my mind, sufficient pressure on the bigger nuclear powers to move toward a nuclear-free world.
We have an interesting email here from Don in Highland Village, who says, regardless of moral and ethical implications, I can't imagine that any sitting U.S. president would not have used the bomb. Pentagon planners were estimating that an invasion of Japan would prolong the war well into 1946, and it would have required redirecting U.S. troops who had fought in Europe. There was serious concern about possible mutinies. Any successful politician would believe that it would unleash a terrible public backlash if he did not use all of the tools available before ordering an invasion.
Well, it's worth remembering, again, we can't know what would have happened, but the United States Bombing Survey, a group of American experts, military and academic, concluded in the fall of 1945 that Japan would have surrendered regardless of the whether nuclear bombs had been used or not, regardless of whether there had been an invasion, regardless of even whether or not Soviet Union invaded them. But so I think minus the atomic bombs, the Soviet entry itself would have led to an end of the war prior to any land invasion. As to whether or not another president might have decided differently, it is true. I would certainly concede that there was a kind of a built-in momentum and pressure for any president who understood that they had been presiding over a top-secret $2 billion, and that sounds like nothing today, but in those days that was the biggest amount of money ever spent on a project like this, to develop a new technology and then not use it. There would have been people who criticized that, but had the war ended, I think it's quite reasonable to think that those criticisms might quickly have fall into the wayside. And so we don't know what would have happened if FDR had lived on. I do think he might well be criticized for not having done a better job of briefing his vice president, who when he came to office in April after FDR died, hadn't even heard about the Manhattan Project and had not been privy to internal debates about the foreign policy and the terms of peace that they were discussing. So it is In a certain sense, I do think that there was a it would have taken, let me put it this way, it would have taken a real moral courage, I think, for the president to say no. The real, that would have been the real decision to say no. It was easy to sort of make a non-decision, which was just sort of to let the momentum of the science and the military project unfold as it had been planned.
If indeed you believe that it would be appropriate for the U.S. to apologize for the use of the atomic bombs, what form would an appropriate apology take?
Well, I think you know, the president speaking on behalf of the United States could certainly make a statement that is important, that all not just in, we always praise individuals who take responsibility for their actions and try to make amends. Why shouldn't mature countries do the same? And that looking back on this this act, it's clear that the victims were not themselves war criminals, but ordinary civilians. And indeed, we had strayed, much of the world had strayed during World War II toward an acceptance of total war, which included targeting of populations and civilians with aerial bombing. It's worth remembering that prior to World War II, there was widespread global outcry about the barbarism of bombing civilian populations. You'll remember that in the Spanish Civil War, Franco's forces bombed towns in Spain like Guernica, where hundreds were killed, and this was considered, not only was this the subject of Picasso's great anti-war painting, Guernica, but was thought to be an absolute crime. And yet, one nation after another, and the United States, it has to be said, especially by the end of the war, was routinely targeting civilians from the air. So, I mean, I do think it's possible to look back on this history and express our regrets.
Do you think the only situation in which a nuclear weapon could ever be used is one in which one's target does not also, or one's target's allies do not also possess similar weapons?
I don't think there is a defense for the use of nuclear weapons. In part because once you use one, the danger that it will escalate into the use of multiple weapons. And, you know, there have been studies that have shown that even a nuclear war between some of the smaller nuclear powers, let's say one of the more plausible would be between India and Pakistan, could itself produce a nuclear winter effect that would block out enough of the sun's rays to lead to the extinction of human life throughout the planet. So I really do think it's a technology that has to be completely abolished.
Christian Appy is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You can read his article about the American bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki online at Salon.com, also at Tom Dispatch. He's also the author of a book out earlier this year called American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. Christian, it's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.